It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and today on this program we conclude Ripple Effects. That's our summer series exploring Iowa's environmental challenges. Mondays, I hope you've been enjoying us tackle these various issues, environmental issues that Iowans face, some of the most pressing ones. If you haven't, you can, of course, go back, listen to the podcast that we have online at iowapublicradio.org. Today we conclude our summer series, Ripple Effects, with a look at environmental policy. When should the government intervene and how? Joining us to discuss this at federal, state, and local levels later in the program, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Bill Northey will be with us. Also, Des Moines Mayor Frank County, State Senator Rob Hogue, and Monroe County Supervisor Dennis Ryan. But let's start at the top of the list there with a federal look at our issue today. U.S. Senator Charles Grassley joins us from Washington. Senator Grassley, welcome again to the program.
I'm always glad to be with you, and if you want to ask me more often, I'll be back.
Okay, sure thing. Now, let's talk a little bit about the politics that we've seen change, the politics of environmental policies. The Clean Air Act, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, was last amended in 1990, overwhelming bipartisan support at that time. The Clean Water Act passed 42 years ago, hailed as a great bipartisan accomplishment. Is this kind of sweeping environmental policy still possible in today's climate?
Well, I think if you look at how comprehensive the Clean Air Act is and the Clean Water Act, they're very flexible, and I think they've been very successful. And I don't think they're controversial anymore in the sense that just about everybody agrees that these acts are good acts. Only when you get to areas where You know, the present Congress or future Congresses, for that matter, they may feel that some of the people administering these acts go beyond the original intent of these acts, and that instead of something being done by regulation, it should be done by amending the statutes. That's about the only thing that becomes controversial. The basic legislation itself is no longer controversial.
Mm-hmm. How do you see, is that the way then you describe the Republican Democratic divide when it comes to environmental law? Are they in agreement, really? It's just how to do it?
I think that you'd only find that, well, if you're talking about is there a divide among Republicans and Democrats about what the Clean Air Act is since it passed and the Clean Water Act, I don't think there's any division there. You get division when specific regulations are seen to be going beyond what the statute was originally intended. And I think if I can answer your question this way, I think Democrats are willing to give the bureaucracies that administer these laws more leeway than maybe Republicans are.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the renewable energy production tax credit. You've been very active in promoting it. And it's been largely credited for making Iowa's second in the nation in wind energy production. Now, the credit was not renewed at the end of the year. Why not?
It was not renewed, and it will be renewed before this year is out, and should have been renewed before last year was out. But it gets swept up in things that are much bigger than the wind energy tax credit, because it's one of just 53 tax policies that sunset December 31st, and wind energy is one of those 53, and all 53 of them will be reenacted at the same time. Now, it does happen that some people are trying to make wind energy a little more controversial and want to single it out in some ways, in ways in which absolutely I, as the father or now the grandfather of the wind energy tax credit, dislikes, because I think it's been very successful, and I want to leave it alone. We could phase it out over a period of 4 or 5 years. I think it'll stand on its own at the end of that period of time. But in the meantime, there's a lot of people with the nuclear industry and with natural gas that don't like wind energy because they see it cutting into their production of electricity. But on the other hand, I think that you got to have a comprehensive energy policy. I'm not just a wind energy person or a green energy person. I'm for conservation, I'm for nuclear, and I'm for fossil fuels to be used as long as it needed to be used until the renewables can fill the void.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any doubt that you will have it renewed here in this next session?
I don't have any doubt about it getting through the Senate without controversy, or some controversy, because Senator Alexander of Tennessee doesn't like wind energy. But beyond a handful of people, well, we had a vote in the committee to strike it out, and I beat that amendment 18-5. So that gives you some idea, I think, the strength in the Senate. I can't predict for the House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about ethanol a little bit. You've been a strong proponent of ethanol, and during this series, we've learned that the high price of corn has driven up production, and that comes with its own set of environmental costs, soil erosion, runoff, planting large swaths of land that may be left otherwise, marginal land being put back into production. How do you balance the interests of the environment with other interests of farmers, of which you are one?
Yeah. Well, of course, don't forget, ethanol is a renewable fuel. You could say it's part of solar energy because of photosynthesis. It's very easy because we've had plenty of studies that have shown that the average corn ethanol reduces greenhouse gas emissions by 34%. We've had studies by independent scientists at the Argonne National Laboratory, I think Purdue, Nebraska, Michigan State, Oak Ridge, the University of Illinois Chicago, showing that it's very beneficial to the environment. And more importantly, as the ethanol industry expands and more science goes into it, it becomes much more efficient. We used to, when we started out 30 years ago, get 2 3/10 gallons of ethanol from a bushel of corn. Today it's about 2.8, and you just recently read about some technology developed at the Galva plant, or Ida Grove plant as an example, where they were able to increase efficiency by 6% more just because of a byproduct, running it through this is a byproduct of a kernel of corn, running that through an additional process that increased efficiency by 6%. So you could easily get 3 gallons from a bushel of corn. And when you get done with the corn, there's still 18 pounds, or a third of the 56 pounds of a bushel of corn left over for animal feed. So, you know, you don't get into this argument that it's a choice of feed, food, or energy. It's a case of you can have both.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Senator Grassley, let me ask you about climate change. Do you believe in the science, the vast majority of climate scientists agreeing that climate warming trends over the past century are very likely due to human activities?
I've always and still believe in that, but I do sense some rethinking by some scientists and some additional research, and then the latest statistic of the Earth not warming in the last 14, 15, 16 years that raises questions. But I'm willing to assume that you need something done to stop CO2 emissions, but I don't think it should be done by one country, the United States, because even our EPA director has said it won't do any good if we do it by ourselves. So I've always been a proponent of an international agreement so that every country is on a level playing field to reduce emissions, because China, India, Indonesia, and Brazil are each putting in more into the air than we do. So it's got to be a global solution, not just a USA solution.
Mm-hmm. So if that global solution is not attainable, the U.S. should not take any steps.
Well, because of the fact that if the United States did take steps. Now, let me tell you, I could buy into an argument of the United States taking steps if you could show me that the rest of the world would follow along. But I don't believe that that's possible, and I don't think anybody can show it to me. And I don't think we ought to harm the U.S. economy for the benefit of China, because we're going to lose, if China doesn't do something, we're going to lose more manufacturing to China. And you're not going to improve the CO emissions any by doing that. That's why it's got to be a global agreement.
U.S. Senator Charles Grassley, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you for joining us again.
You bet. Thank you very much. Call me back if you want me.
I sure will. Thank you. Charles Grassley, U.S. Senator from Washington Live. Ripple Effects, our summer series concluding today, exploring Iowa's environmental challenges today with a look at environmental policy. If you'd like to join our conversation, perhaps tell us where you've seen successful environmental policies at work in your part of the state. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Also, you can be a part of our conversation on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page or tweet us at IPR Talk. Well, we're kind of working our way from the federal perspective down to the local level, but we're going to Des Moines Mayor Frank County next, who is in our Des Moines studio. Mayor County, welcome to our program.
Well, good morning.
You've been in though a mayor of Des Moines, you've been involved at a national level. Let's talk a little bit about that, and a little bit later we'll talk about some of the local initiatives that you've led in the Des Moines area. In May, you and Des Moines hosted President Obama's Task Force on Climate Preparedness and Resilience. I understand it's a group representing 8 governors, 16 mayors, 2 tribal representatives, set to make some recommendations to the president on how to prepare for and reduce the impact of climate change. What recommendations have you made so far?
Well, I think it's a collective effort on the part of all the participants, because I think what we are trying to do is focus on what is actually happening across the country in terms of impacts of climate change, whether it has to do with buildings and people's lives or water quality or, quite frankly, in Iowa, the future of agriculture. And so we look at all those pieces. We look at and all the members, by the way, of this task force have been those who have seen the impacts in their states or in their cities or the tribal representatives as well. So we are all bringing some experience with extreme events to the table.
Primarily Midwest states?
Well, no. There's, quite frankly, the majority of the folks, the governors and the mayors are on coastal areas. I think there's 6 of us that would lean more towards Midwest or central part of the United States viewpoints. But we do bring a voice to the table because, you know, even in Des Moines, we've seen, let's say, in 2008, 2010, we've seen 4 near 500-year flood events in the city of Des Moines. So we bring some experience in dealing with extreme weather and in the conditions and what we have to do to prepare for future events, mitigate future events, and make sure that when we recover, we don't go back and do the same thing again. We look at how we can resiliently recover and say, how do we make it better? Are there places we really shouldn't build anymore, for instance? And look at all the impacts. So we all bring a lot of ideas and thoughts to the table. I will tell you, the input has been very extensive. I believe at the moment we are reviewing about 464 different recommendations that we are giving this administration. It's a bipartisan effort. And so we're just talking about what happens in real places to real people. Has nothing to do with partisanship.
Mm-hmm. It's a bipartisan group of governors and mayors.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you get a group like this all together, how much are you on the same page about what needs to be done? That collection of 400-some recommendations, are they all over the map? Or can you say, this is something we almost all of us agree on?
I think that there's obviously with 464 of them, there's an awful lot of them that have a lot of overlap. We had a number of different subcommittees that we worked with. There was, you know, a disaster preparedness and recovery group. There was a built systems group. There's a natural resources group. And there was a communities and public health kind of a group. So we all kind of – and then the tribal groups tried to step into all four of those subgroups because there were two of them. But mm-hmm. obviously they have some issues. So there is overlap. But I think that across the board, yep. there is agreement on what needs to be done. But obviously, for Hurricane Sandy, it's a much different, more widespread kind of an event that happens around a hurricane than, let's say, a tornado that wipes a whole city out. And the resources that you have to throw at each of these events is sometimes much different and needs to be looked at a little bit differently.
Mayor County, can you give me one concrete example of a recommendation for climate preparedness and resilience that you've come up with that you're sure to say, this is something we can all agree on and this will go forward to the president?
Well, I think that out of my group, which was the disaster recovery group, we looked overall at some basic ideas and we sort of put them together into groups. We think that as we look at recovery, number one, we ought to look at how we make investments, whether it's federal dollars, state dollars, local dollars. We need to recover stronger. It means let's not do things the same way that we've been doing it before. So, you know, we're looking at how the federal government responds and what it is, what kind of planning that they can throw at us. How do we work with FEMA and HUD and EPA and DOT and DOL and everybody else that works at it, in it and do, you know, peer exchanges and those kinds of things. But there's lots of different categories, but I think one of the main ones that we thought is let's not keep doing it the same way. How do we work together, federal, state, local, to make sure that we're not making the same mistakes and let's recover stronger?
Des Moines Mayor Frank County, I know you have a number of local initiatives, and we do want to talk about those a bit later. But according to our plan, we want to kind of work from the national view down to the state and local level. So please hang on in our Des Moines studio, Frank County, Des Moines Mayor. Let's welcome Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Bill Northey to our conversation, joining us by phone. Secretary Northey, welcome.
Good afternoon. Great to be with you.
Great to have you on our program. You serve as co-chair of the Mississippi River Gulf of Mexico Watershed Nutrient Task Force. Now, we've talked about water quality in this series extensively this July. Remind us of the problem. Let's make sure we understand the problem that your task force is tackling. This is a problem of nutrients. Nutrients from our farmland, from our streams, rivers, flowing into the Mississippi, getting into the Gulf of Mexico and creating all kinds of problems along the way and down and in the Gulf.
So the nutrients we're talking about is nitrogen and phosphorus. And as those leave our cities and our farms, our point sources and non-point sources, we end up with more of that going down the river than used to, but also the river has changed. We used to have wetlands along the river that are not there now, especially down at the Gulf. And so as that moves out into the Gulf of Mexico, it will encourage algae production. And as that algae dies off, you end up using up oxygen, and it creates what's called a hypoxic zone. And that hypoxia means it's low in oxygen. And the problem that creates is that the life in that water, certainly shrimp and other fish, will not be able to thrive in an area of low oxygen, so they leave those areas. And we end up with an area that varies in size every year, but is such that we'd certainly like to reduce the size of that area. The Hypoxia Task Force has said our goal is to get to an area of 5,000 square kilometers, which would be about a third of what it is now in a normal year, a third or a fourth. We see great variability in that, so not only the amount of nutrients going down the river, but certainly the weather that happens up above the river or up in the river basin, the whole Mississippi River basin, has an impact on how big that zone is every year.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no one place to be able to make the reductions, but But we have lots of states involved here that are looking at lots of pieces. We're looking at urban, we're looking at rural, we're looking at point sources being our sewage treatment plants, our industrial facilities, as well as non-point source being our farms, and our urban non-point source or stormwater drains. The combination of all those, reducing the amount of loss from all those, will have an impact over time on that area of the hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico.
Iowa farmers can tap into some state assistance that's available. It's voluntary. How does it work?
So we started this program 2 years ago. The legislature provided some dollars as we requested some dollars for a water quality initiative. And we have two different kind of pools of money. One is some money for a statewide initiative to encourage the use of cover crops. These are crops that go on that farmland after harvest or at least are grown from harvest 1 year in the fall to planting the next year. So we're covering that ground. That reduces erosion off that land. It also takes up some of the nitrogen that's in that land. We last year had about 100,000 acres and about 1,000 farmers that applied for cover crops. This year we just closed that. We had available $1.4 million, so we had 50,000 acres and 500 farmers that participated in that program to put cover crops on their land and or use a couple tillage methods called strip till or no-till to reduce the erosion, or nitrification inhibitors, which help hold that nitrogen in place. The other pool of dollars is for our watershed demonstration projects, and we now have 13 of those across the state in priority watersheds. And this is to learn how we scale this up. How do we increase from a few percent of the acres in cover crops to 10 or 20 or 30%? What are our barriers? We have staff in those areas that will work more closely with farmers.
Secretary Northey, we're coming up on a break. I just wanted to have you answer this one question. It's a voluntary program. If this is so vital, why not take the other approach, the stick? Why not make it mandatory, since you will agree this is really crucial for our future in a lot of ways?
It is very important. I believe the best way to get improvement is in a way that engages producers, encourages innovation, brings them to the table. And so I think a voluntary program is going to be much more effective than a regulatory program.
Okay, please stay with us. Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Bill Northey is with us, and along with Des Moines Mayor Frank County, also to join our conversation a little later, State Senator Rob Hogue and Monroe County Supervisor Dennis Ryan. Join our conversation 1-866-780-9100. As today we conclude our summer series, the last half hour of Ripple Effects. All through the month of July, Monday, we've been looking at the impact we have on the environment, what we can do to better it. Environmental policy, what we're talking about today. Back in just a few minutes, it's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On this Monday, we're concluding our Monday, July series, the summer series, Ripple Effects. So we explore Iowa's environmental challenges, some of the most pressing issues that we as Iowans face. And, of course, we see that we're connected not only with the rest of the country, but with the world. And we're winding it up this hour with a look at environmental policy. When and how should the government intervene? What's the most effective way to do that? We have with us in our Des Moines studio, Des Moines Mayor Frank County. We'll talk with him in just a few minutes about some of the local initiatives that have met with success in the Des Moines area. We also have Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Bill Northey with us. He serves as the co-chair of the Mississippi River Gulf of Mexico Watershed Nutrient Task Force, looking at that problem of the dead zone being caused by all the nutrients, the nitrogen and phosphorus running from our farmland down the Mississippi into the Gulf of Mexico. Bill Northey, let me ask you about this. I understand that you want to encourage with incentives farmers to do this. It sounds like the program is getting a lot of response, a lot of takers among farmers to encourage them to have cover crops, no-till planting. But what about the bad actors? Does a program that is voluntary like this really get at the bad actors if they can just ignore it?
You know, one of the challenges certainly is to be able to assure ourselves that folks are doing this. So that's suggested in your question. I really think that it does over time, and I think it certainly engages the public in a lot better way. So that we tap into that ethic that's out there already in caring for the land and caring for the community, that encouragement of innovation. We're encouraging the same kinds of tools that would be available to look at in a regulatory system, but we're discovering those better ways for farmers to use it.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the challenges is land varies greatly across the state. Farmers vary greatly across the state. And a regulatory approach would have to reach across all those, be appropriate, and then have the appropriate kind of follow-through to be able to determine, first of all, what should each of those farmers be doing, and then what are the penalties for them not doing that. And I think you create a framework where you have a really hard time directing folks better than they can what they should be doing from the outside. You create a confrontational approach, and you freeze that opportunity for innovation that we think that we're really tapping into.
Let me voice some criticism by environmental groups that say this doesn't go far enough. David Osterberg, founder of the Iowa Policy Project, says of this nutrient reduction strategy, we need to make sure this isn't just window dressing. Folks want water quality. We shouldn't just use this nutrient reduction strategy as a way not to do anything. We pretend we're getting after it, but we're not getting after it very well.
Well, I obviously disagree. I think this is very obvious progress. And in fact, you'll talk to folks from other states, they recognize Iowa as a place that is more aggressive than almost any place else in addressing water quality issues. It's got a better engagement of our producers, our agribusiness community. You talk to producers, we had 500 producers that came forward in the last week that said they would put some of their own money on the line to do projects they have never done before, either cover crop strip-till, no-till, or nitrification inhibitors. And we engaged them because we had the support. We're encouraging a lot of folks to get to field days, find out what works on their land, find out what's working on their neighbor's ground. I think we have really ramped up the interest in the issue. We have encouraged those that work with farmers to be engaged and bring new technologies to farmers. And so I think we're making great progress, and certainly I guess anything that anybody does, certainly innovative and creative and aggressive, is going to attract detractors.
Right. Earlier this year, Governor Branstad chopped tens of millions of dollars in state spending that legislators had approved. Among the cuts, the governor cut over $11 million in money for water quality and conservation programs under your Department of Agriculture. You voiced some criticism of your fellow Republican, the governor, saying it was, quote, a lost opportunity. What opportunity was lost when the governor cut over $11 million from money for water quality and conservation programs under your department?
Well, I think we had an opportunity to be able to have more dollars available for cost share for programs. Our program this year for the statewide mostly cover crop initiative was $1.4 million versus $2.8 million a year ago. Certainly could have been bigger than that. We could have encouraged more producers. These watershed projects, we have 13 of them out there. We could have more watershed projects. Those dollars really leverage themselves into many dollars of investment by producers as well. So that $11 to $12 million that did not come to us probably had an impact over time of $25 to $30 million worth of investment in water quality initiatives. So it was an important opportunity. I think there's a lot of things the governor has to balance when they look at the budget. We certainly are going to make a strong case for water quality investment as we go forward.
Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Bill Northey, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thank you, Ben.
And let's move on. We still have Des Moines Mayor Frank County. We're not forgetting you, Mayor County, in our Des Moines studio. We'll get back to you. But I want to introduce State Senator Rob Hoeg to our conversation. He's in our Iowa City studio. Senator Hoeg, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
While we're on the topic, let's get your take on this nutrient reduction strategy, this volunteer program that's in place that had some funding cut.
Well, it's good to be on the show with Secretary Northey and Senator Grassley. I've been very supportive of a nutrient reduction strategy. I appreciate Secretary Northey's leadership on it. I think one of the differences is the magnitude of the problem. Secretary Northey, representing Iowa on the task force, has said we need to cut our nitrogen and phosphorus by, I think it's over 40%. So that's a major reduction that we need to achieve. We also have the local problems with our rivers and streams in Iowa, nearly 500 impaired waterways with over 600 impairments, and we need to deal with that. And, you know, I've been supportive of the culture that Secretary Northey's been nurturing with getting more producers voluntarily engaged. But when Governor Branstad vetoes the additional money that had strong bipartisan support in the legislature led by the Senate Democrats, it really cuts the legs out from under the program. You know, we've got 500 farmers, 50,000 acres, but we've got 24 million acres of farmland in the state. And so if we do the 1.4 million a year approach, that's less than 10 cents an acre. For farmland in the state, we're on a 200-year plan to have clean water, and that's not good enough. So it either requires more investment, or it doesn't require. You know, people use this word mandates, but think of it this way: it's really the rules of the game. You know, when the NFL has a problem with quarterbacks getting concussions, they change the rules to be protective of the quarterback, and that applies to everybody. So I think
you mean as opposed to providing incentives to protect the quarterback, but change the rules, the
right?
They
actually change the rules, and the problem is when they don't enforce the rules. But sometimes you got to change the rules, you got to update it. So I've been supportive of the voluntary approach that Secretary Northey's had. I've been supportive of that, but it's got to, if you're going to do it, you got to put the dollars into it. And I'll tell you,
is there enough funding to do that now? I mean, do we have funding at a state and federal level to do what you're saying?
When we left the legislative session where we had passed the additional $11.2 million for clean water, which in my view was on the low end of what we need, we had $1.4 billion in our bank accounts. Well, Governor Branstad prioritized saving up money in the bank accounts over putting people to work in Iowa's fields. Cleaning up our water, and the problem doesn't go away if you ignore it. You've got to make that investment.
Mm-hmm. Senator Rob Hoeg, I mentioned too that you're a Cedar Rapids Democrat and you serve on the Senate's Natural Resources and Environment Committee. I want to talk about a couple of other things. We don't have all the areas that you are active in, but going forward, you want to make some bills into law. For instance, restoring some funding to the Resource Enhancement and Protection area, REAP, as it is commonly known. What happened to the funding?
Well, again, this was something where we worked very, very hard to develop bipartisan support for $25 million for REAP this year on the 25th anniversary.
Quickly, what is REAP so people know?
REAP is a program that invests in natural resources around the state. For example, in Cedar Rapids, it's been the Prairie Park Fishery or Wickiup Hill. Or the Vietchny Woods or the Cedar River Trail, a lot of bike trails, a lot of natural resource recreation areas. If you like to hunt, fish, bird, recreate, go hiking, REAP is behind a lot of the opportunities that we have for that in the state, and we want to continue to build on those opportunities.
Why did it get cut?
Again, it was a Governor Branstad veto, you'd kind of have to ask him why you'd do it. Again, we're in a strong fiscal position. This is not money that goes down a hole. It's money that gets invested in our communities, in our natural resources, and really provides the quality of life that attracts people to the state. And that's the direction we need to go. Again, you got to have government involved in this. Private land conservation is good, and it goes so far. But if you want to have the natural resources, if you want to have hunting, fishing, recreational opportunities, you've got to have government involved. people can't just buy their own property and hunt their own land, because that's not how nature works. Mm-hmm. Nature crosses property boundaries. Mm-hmm. And so you got to have government setting the rules, being involved to provide the real quality of life opportunities that we want.
Over the last few years, we've seen the hyperpartisan develop at a national level in so many issues. What about the environment? How are you working? Do you have partners in the Republican Party that you see eye to eye with and can advance these environmental issues and laws?
Sure. There are people we're working together. It's a process. I will say this. The things we've been able to accomplish have been primarily with Senate Democratic leadership. But, you know, you look for willing partners so that you can get so you can negotiate. And we accomplished that this year on both the Clean Water Initiative and the REAP funding, and unfortunately ran into the vetoes. There is a really rich Republican tradition on the environment. You go back to Teddy Roosevelt, even Ronald Reagan. I want to use a quick example with you here. Ronald Reagan, when the ozone depletion issue came up, he kind of at first made fun of it and said, just wear hats and more sunscreen. But what did he do? He listened to the science. He signed the Montreal Protocol in 1987 to fight stratospheric ozone depletion. George H.W. Bush strengthened that agreement. So there's a rich tradition there on the Republican Party, and this is not something that should be a partisan issue. We should unite. But unfortunately, there are Republican voices. I was glad to hear that Senator Grassley was not one of them. But there are Republican voices out there right now who want to repeal the Clean Water Act, just do away with it. And that would be moving in the wrong direction.
State Senator Rob Hoag. Let's welcome Monroe County Supervisor Dennis Ryan to our program by phone. Hello, Supervisor Ryan.
Hey, how you doing?
Pretty good. Monroe County in the south central part of our state. We asked you on the program to have you quickly tell us about a success you had in establishing the first recycling program in Monroe County. Quickly, tell us that story.
Yeah, I've been on the board 24 years, and one of the things I ran on 24 years ago was to get recycling going in the county. And we first did that by purchasing a couple of trailers. And actually, the Board of Supervisors manned those trailers along with the mayors of the three cities in our county, and we'd do it on weekends. Well, this past year, we got a swap grant from the Iowa DNR, and we matched that and built onto a facility we have here in Albia and made it so it was 24-hour drop-off any time of the day somebody wants to come and drop their recyclables off.
And the response to that has been?
Oh, it's been tremendous. People first didn't realize what we were doing. They were kind of waiting for us to wait on them on Saturdays. And when they find out that they can go any time of the day they want to, it's been a tremendous upswing in the amount of recyclables we've gotten. And it's more of a convenience to our customers. They can go whenever they want to, and they're understanding the learning curve of what they can recycle on their own without having somebody there to lead them through it. It's been great. People have really caught on. They really like it.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about perhaps lessons learned in taking this from zero to the success you have today with this recycling program. What have you learned?
Well, the one thing is there's a learning curve that goes with anything. You know, just because it says recyclable on the container doesn't mean that we can take it or that we can take it in a certain condition. And, you know, getting the rinsing and the cleanness and not taking basically garbage, you know, and contaminating some of the load and stuff like that, it's been a learning curve that way. But people, we've had the same people recycling ever since we started, and it's grown. And it's, you know, your regulars, you know how to do it, and they kind of lead by example and help other people along. They'll tell their neighbors or their
You want to expand friends. That pool, right?
Yeah, so we keep trying to expand, and I think that's what's happening too. It's starting to expand, and it's finally catching on that sometimes people want to do things on their own. They don't want somebody overseeing them to do it. They want to do the right thing. They want to, you know, try to help the environment. They want to try and help their community. So it's one of those things they're proud of doing. And the ones that really do it well, they do it. They teach others to do it.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you're in the carrot approach rather than the stick approach. We were having that discussion earlier.
I could see both sides of the equation on that, and we chose to do the carrot, I guess. So.
Okay. Monroe County Supervisor Dennis Ryan, thank you for joining us.
You're sure welcome. Thank you.
Let's wind up the hour with comments from State Senator Rob Hoke. But first of all, Des Moines Mayor Frank County and our Des Moines studio list. We don't have much time left, but you've had quite a number of successes on local initiatives. Tell us about the local actions that you've led that you count as your biggest success.
Well, the city of Des Moines and our staff has done a great job. I mean, obviously, all the way back to 1993 and up till today, we've made huge improvements in protecting our citizens and our businesses and looking at whether it's levees or it's runoff, it's ways to improve levees, pump stations from behind, because sometimes you have a combination of storm sewer and sanitary sewer overflow that can cause a problem behind, especially when the river gets really high around levees. We have made huge investments in those areas, and quite frankly, it is, as I've listened to this discussion, the city of Des Moines and cities all across this state, and Senator Hogue and I have talked together on some of these issues around the state, have worked so hard to do the best that we can do. The city of Des Moines, for instance, has been, quite frankly, sued by EPA to improve our water quality. So we're doing a sewer separation, storm and sanitary. And I would tell you that Des Moines probably is represents less than 1% of any of the pollution that goes into the rivers. The issue is when you take $275 to $300 million to make that separation, we would go much further down the road to clean up Iowa's water, to go up the watersheds of the Des Moines and the Raccoon and invest money with the state and with the federal government to clean up some of these issues. Through the years, we've cut down 60-70% of our tree cover across this state. Mm-hmm. We have made so many changes. We have to all work together. It's local government.
But it sounds like you may be more in tune rather than when we talk about Secretary Northey and State Senator Rob Hoke. You're saying incentives are not enough?
I don't believe that they are. Obviously, the incentives are not enough with cities and the urban areas in this state. We're looking at a stick, if you will, that is through a consent decree. Otherwise, we're going to have a $275, $300 million judgment hanging over our heads. Now, we're over $150 million into that investment to make it happen. But I'm telling you that at the end of the day, we're not going to go as far cleaning up Iowa's water as I would like to see. City of Des Moines will continue to do everything that we can, working with the private sector, working with the state government, county government, federal government, to do what we can to clean up everything and use less energy, incent businesses to build more effectively, more efficiently. And we have made great strides in doing that. Des Moines has the world's largest single-occupant, single-owner LEED Platinum building in the world, and we have a whole number of those around our city. And the city led by example to get and show people how to do with it and partner with it.
Okay.
We could use that as an example and work with state government, as Senator Hogan suggested, and let's look at both sticks and carrots. That's how we're going to make things happen.
Rob Hogue, Senator Hogue, yep. let me end with you. Talk about what level of government can do the most good for environmental policy.
Depends on the issue. Depends on the issue. You've heard a great story about local governments making a difference, the recycling programs. You've heard about state government. The federal government has a leadership role on the national and international problems. Here's what's exciting to me. You see more and more people speaking up and getting involved. People know it's not enough just to act, in an environmentally sustainable manner as an individual. We've got to come together as a community. I want to share a story. A 14-year-old girl.
30 seconds.
Yep. A 14-year-old girl, Glory Day Philippone, spoke at a rally I had in April 2013 at the Capitol. Her opening line was, "How many of you brought your own atmosphere here today?" Right? And the point is we're all in this together. If you want clean water, if you want good natural resources, if you want a safe climate, we've got to work together. More people getting involved, the momentum's building, and I think this country and the state can do great things in the years ahead.
Okay, State Senator Rob Hoge, serving on the Senate's Natural Resources and Environment Committee. Des Moines Mayor Frank County, thank you for joining us in our Des Moines studio.
You bet.
This wraps up Ripple Effects, our Monday summer series during the month of July, as we explore Iowa's environmental challenges. Thanks for listening. If you want to go back to listen to maybe an episode you didn't get to, go to iowapublicradio.org, listen to a podcast. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. John Pemble helped us out in Des Moines. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. Recent polls showing a majority of Americans now say the war in Iraq was not worth it, and the similar sentiment was found in polls from the Vietnam era. Tomorrow on the program, we compare those two wars with an Iraq vet, also a Vietnam vet, and Dennis Goldford, political analyst. We hope you'll join us. I'm Ben Kiefer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for joining us.